I'm Winna Liu. I write the game Connections, one of the puzzles from New York Times Games, and I love horror movies. I love my dog, and I love trying to trick you.
I'm Tracy Bennett. I get to pick the Wordle word every day, which is not as easy as it sounds. A fun fact about me is that I am descended from a witch who was put on trial in Salem.
New York Times Games are made by people, like the ones you just heard from. Go to nytimes.com/games to start playing today.
Is there a chance for more euphoria moving forward?
In terms of the story that we set out to tell, which is a story about addiction and its consequences, this feels like the end to me.
So that's it.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your America, my dream. A weekly culture chat. I'm John Caramonica, and I'm the critic.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I am the reporter.
I'm Sam Levinson, and I'm on Popcast.
Ooh, boy.
Nailed it.
Heavy. Not everyone can nail it. Yeah. Many professional actors and musicians have failed.
This is good.
Failed at this very part.
I had one job to do.
Yeah, we're off and running. Sam Levinson is the creator, writer, director, and producer of Euphoria, which just ended its third season on HBO. We're going to talk about it. Euphoria started airing in 2019 as a hyper-stylized high school drama starring Zendaya as Rue Bennett, a drug-addicted student, alongside one of the most stacked ensembles of young actors ever assembled on TV. In the course of its run, Euphoria helped make stars out of Sydney Sweeney, who plays Cassie, Jacob Elordi, who plays Nate. There's Hunter Schafer as Jules, Coleman Domingo, Ali, Maude Apatow, many, many, many more round out this insane cast. This third season picked up more than 4 years after season two, and it found the characters in much different life stations.
So you're working?
Yeah.
At a strip club. It's managerial stuff.
They're out of high school, into the cold evil of the real world, all trying to keep their heads above water, many using some form of sex work or its surrounding economies in the face of money problems and more existential crises as well. When this interview comes out, the finale will have just aired. I should note, we are going to spoil the Euphoria finale and the entire season. So if you want to watch that first and then come back to hear us speak with Sam Levinson, subscribe youtube.com/popcast. I think we have to start at the end with this gutting epic finale. Obviously, what happens here, Rue overdosing on fentanyl and dying, closely tracks with an experience that you had in making this show with Angus Cloud, who played Fez. And we're starting hard and deep, but I wonder if you can just talk about when you knew Euphoria had to end this way, or at least Rue's story.
It's a good question, because I had originally written kind of a very different, it's not that different, but you know, there was a different trajectory for the character of Rue. And this was during the writer's strike. And, you know, we got the news that Angus passed away. I had always been really concerned about the prevalence of fentanyl. And, you know, it's something that, you know, we've dealt with over the seasons. But once he passed away, I had to sort of reconceive of the script. And I thought, you can't tell a story about addiction today without the very real consequences. Most people don't get a second chance. Fentanyl can just take you out in an instant. It wasn't like when I was growing up, you know, you could, you know, literally take pills off the street. Mm-hmm. You might have a bad trip or something, but you'd be fine. And this is something that I think is hit close to home for a lot of people in this country. I mean, the numbers of overdoses are staggering. You know, you're talking 75,000 people a year. If we were really going to be saying something with this season, we needed to put the audience in the position of a family member who loses someone that they love. I wanted to mirror that feeling. And I know how much audiences love Rue. It felt like I can put them in the position that I think a lot of families are in.
I thought you made an interesting choice, and it wasn't something that I understood until I saw the last episode, but Rue's addiction has been such a big part of the show in season one and season two. And in season three, it really takes a back seat.
Yeah.
And there's a couple mentions of whether she's using or not using throughout the season, but you have the sense that it is no longer the most meaningful battle that she's fighting in her life. And then in the last episode, it comes out of nowhere like a huge smack from on high. Was it intentional that you obscured this idea that Rue could still fall victim to her addiction at any moment, because that's true to your experience of addiction, whether your own or others?
100%. I think that addictive personality is always underneath the surface. You know, I thought in my head, she's not messing around with opiates. And in the end, she's, you know, banged up. She hit herself in the face. Her hand got cut. She's looking at her hand, and there's this pain there. And I always thought of it as like kind of a window into whatever pain is going on in her psyche. And she feels, okay, I'll just take one. And I always imagined it was the fentanyl that she had smuggled into the country in the first episode that ends up killing Tish, that, you know, they saved whatever those ecstasy pills were and just kind of mixed it with the Percocets. Mm.
You said a minute ago if the show was going to say something this season, and I wonder if you could think about what season one of the show said, what season two of the show said, and what season three of the show said. How do you think that message has changed? The shape of it has changed season to season.
It's always said a similar thing. It's, you know, here's the seduction of drugs, of sex. You know, we shoot it in a very kind of alluring way. And then we show the consequences of it. Yeah, I always looked at it like the three steps of AA, right? The first season is, you know, we admit that we're powerless over drugs and alcohol and our life is unmanageable. Second season is came to believe that only a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So you see there's these kind of moments of the church, of her kind of wrestling with the spiritual side of things, but it's very much the subtext of it. It takes a back seat. And the you know, even in the diner episode.
Ali, I don't believe in God.
Guess what? God doesn't give a fuck if you believe in him. He believes in you.
I don't know. That sounds good, but it doesn't really mean anything.
The third season is made a decision to submit our will and our lives to the care of God as we understand him. It's third step and third season.
Right.
That's a new element.
But it ends quite pessimistically.
I don't think it is as pessimistic. I mean, I don't know. Her at the table in the end, kind of, it's grace. There's a...
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of post... It's the...
The denouement.
Yeah. Post-pessimism. But I, you know, I feel like, I guess I look in Ali's eyes in that moment, and even if he's feeling grateful or even if he's feeling engaged, like there's still something, I don't know, I feel like the hopelessness seems to be hovering a little bit behind his head.
Well, I mean, look, we live in a pretty fucked up, you know, world. It's what Lexi says in that conversation with Cassie, where she says, you know, she read the Bible, she doesn't really understand it, but she does know people are always dying, and you just gotta go on. And you know, and I think that there's definitely a fragility there, but it's a renewal of sorts. Maybe if we can kind of get our shit together and take care of our loved ones and maybe believe in something a little greater than ourselves, then we can carve out a future.
I want to talk about the revenge arc as well. So Ali finds Rue overdosed on his couch, and he immediately straps up and goes to work.
Well, he goes to AA.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. He has
to close the door to open the new one.
And express his anger.
Yeah, and talk about how he had relapsed and
right.
kind of lost faith in everything.
Yes, I didn't mean to skip but a yes, step, as and it
then
were.
And then he saws off a shotgun.
Right, and then he saws off a shotgun, and he goes to get payback from Alamo.
Yeah.
Something that he had told Rue that he would do for her while she was still alive.
Yeah.
In the 7th episode of this season.
And if someone's forcing you to do something against your will, I got a 12-gauge shotgun that can take care of that.
It ends in this big duel, a shootout, sort of nodding to the Western themes that have been throughout the season. This anger that Ali is feeling on behalf of his lost protege, his, you know, a surrogate child for him, essentially. It was interesting to me to watch what I felt like your identification with the characters. For so long, Rue seemed like a reflection of you as somebody who had grown up addicted to drugs and tried to work his way out of that. And then seeing perhaps, and tell me if I'm wrong, your identification switch to the elder character. And Ali, and I wonder, were you using Ali's character to channel the anger you felt after Angus's death?
I see myself in every single one of these characters, and I have since the beginning. Mm. Even Jules in the psychiatric hospital in episode 4, season 1, that was an experience that I just took from my own life at the age of 11. And so I've always tried to put myself, or pieces of myself or my life or experiences I've had, into all of these characters to make sure that there's a certain level of authenticity. But yeah, I mean, look, I understand where Ali's coming from. I mean, you know, it's a place of, I think, deep pain. Mm-hmm. And him talking about empathy and the idea that, look, if you can have, you know, empathy as, you know, empathy for the addict, then can't you have empathy for the dealer? You know, I think is a really interesting question and something that I've certainly grappled with. I think that empathy without limits starts to lose its kind of moral shape. Yeah. And I think that's what he's coming up against, is at what point do you just say something is evil? If you're selling poison to kids and you're killing them, it's evil. And what do you do in that situation? How do you confront it? How do you deal with it?
Also, the notion of you, not simply as the creator of the show, but as an individual, as protector, and you've spoken previously about making sure Angus could go to rehab, HBO paid for it. Maybe there are other people in the show as well in a similar situation. Is the protector part of you a dominant force in the creative writer director part, or do you try to keep those things separate?
I think life is such a gift, and to lose it that quickly just breaks my heart. And look, I can't help it. I mean, I sit down and I write, and I try to write from an emotional place as opposed to a kind of academic place. And I'm sure there's a large part of me that identifies with the protector, if that's what you're saying.
I think even you saying the preciousness of life is a thing that you are in your own mind trying to hold tight to. I wonder how many of the characters in the show are aware of the preciousness of life, and are you consciously trying
very
to walk?
Very few.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the body count is high in this season, in particular.
Right. And so, as for a viewer, is part of what you're trying to demonstrate is your commitment to the preciousness of life by showing how easy it is to toss away.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
You mentioned having to rewrite what you thought was the initial ending of the show that you had worked on in around 2023 in the writer's strike.
Yeah, not just the ending, but the
whole season, right? I wonder how much of that rewrite was practical because Angus would no longer be in the season, and how much of it was personal out of a sense of responsibility about the story you had to tell.
First and foremost, it was practical. And then, you know, I think I try to find meaning in what I'm about to do, whether it's writing, whether it's shooting, whether it's directing, editing. I try to, you know, I try to make sure that it's moving or headed towards something that's, you know, fulfilling and matters to me.
I'm curious, why was sex work the right theme and trapping to tell this story? There's so much of this third season, whether it's Jules as a sugar baby, yeah, Hold up as an artist, Rue working at the strip club, Cassie on OnlyFans. Why did you feel like that was the right milieu to tell this particular personal, meaningful story?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, I think it's in line with a character like Jules, who has this kind of rich inner life. She's very talented, creatively speaking. She goes off to art school. You know, in past seasons, she had, you know, was doing random hookups, you know, in motels.
Sure. From the very beginning.
From the very beginning. You know, like, and I think that there's something about the, not just the economy we're in, but the fear of making it as an artist and trading that for security and comfort. I think there's something that's alluring about it, and normalized about sugar baby, you know, sex work adjacent stuff. That is, you know, here's a way where she can continue to create with all of the freedom, but none of the risk. And it felt true to that character. In terms of Cassie and OnlyFans, it's slightly different in the sense that, you know, from day one in this series, Cassie has always been looking for someone to just say, I love you, right? She just wants to be loved. She wants to be adored.
I just feel like if more people knew me, I would be huge.
It feels to me like the natural progression of social media, you know, mm-hmm, whether it's Instagram, any of these things, it's, you're the product, you're the brand. It's based around validation, external validation, affirmation. And what is she going to get the most likes from? Even back to previous seasons, you know, people were sharing her nudes around school. So I think she's sitting there and she's going, you know, there's obviously some money issues that are happening. She wants this wedding. She wants all these flowers. You know, she's dreaming of this wedding, and she realizes this is the justification to kind of chase what she's always wanted to, which is to be loved by as many people as humanly possible.
That's the real wedding in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like more powerful to her than the actual thing.
And I think that's, it's sort of the dramatic irony of the arc is, in the end, she's there back in the house. You know, the camera pulls back and she's still living in the house, and she's kind of trapped in this cycle where she is indeed loved, mm-hmm, by so many people.
She made a content house.
Yeah, she made a content house, and she's loved by, you know, I don't know, a million people out there, strangers, but is what she desired ultimately fulfilling? And I think, you know, the answer is no, she's lonely. And so I kind of approach it from that perspective, as opposed to going, this season I'm going to tackle sex work, or I'm going to tackle, you know, drugs.
So you're saying it's sort of almost coincidental that they all ended up with mirroring thematic storylines?
Well, I think it's a byproduct of culture, mm, and what's going on in terms of social media, where it's headed. I think they're all forms of, I think they're light forms of prostitution.
Much of our lives.
Yeah. And also it's like, these are plot lines that are, it's, the show is not about social media, but the plot lines rely upon the ways that social media activates certain feelings in people. And then real world behaviors emanate from the feelings generated on social media.
Of course.
Yeah.
This season's very much a kind of a frontier myth, mm-hmm, it's sort of an American tall tale. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if you head out west, you can, you can get rich quick. You can make it with a little bit of rugged individualism. And, you know, and what are the jobs? They're sort of outside the kind of normal, respectable idea of work. They're a little bit on the margins and on the edge.
Like, what is wrong with you people? You're looking for drugs, you're selling your body on your porn site, and you're like some internet pimp?
2019, 2022, 2026, a lot of space in between the seasons of Euphoria. The social media story that you're telling in the third season couldn't have even really been conceived of in the first season. There was so much has changed. Can you talk about what you think the character's relationship to the internet was in the first season, and what did you want? How did you want to evolve that over the course of the thing? Because I just feel like you couldn't make this version of the show back then, pre-COVID.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the pandemic changed a lot in terms of the internet. I mean, and it's also, it became, I think, a truly viable source of income. Mm-hmm. The ghost of the internet is sort of haunted all three of these seasons. Yep. Without getting into it, you know, too much or pointing too many cameras at computers and stuff. I think there's a sense of who you are. You know, you can have a sense of yourself, and then there's also a persona. And I think all the characters are sort of straddling this line between who they are and what their persona is. And that's something that is a byproduct of the internet. And social media specifically.
What are your internet consumption habits and how have they changed over the last few years?
I'm not a big poster of things.
You have a lot of burner accounts where you're watching stories or you're watching TikToks?
No, I just have, like, I have an X account where I watch things, you know, before it was Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a private Instagram. Mm-hmm. TikTok I won't download onto my phone. I've never been on TikTok. Okay. I just, when it first came out and they said that like the American military shouldn't download it, mm-hmm. I thought that I ought to take that as a sign.
Sure. That applied to you as well.
I was like, all right, well then why can't they download it? Like, that's scary. That's spooky.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we brought it in-house, so it's all good, right?
Yeah.
That's as far as I understand.
Are you on TikTok?
Yes.
You're on TikTok?
On TikTok is not how I would describe it.
No?
I use it for work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not, have I don't noticed, spend personal time on
have
TikTok.
Have you noticed like real shifts in the
I've noticed worse. Real shifts in John from his time on TikTok. Yeah.
Less present, doesn't talk as much, you know?
Sound like my family.
My parents love TikTok.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they posting or they're just viewing?
No, they're not posting. But, my dad always says, you know, I saw this this girl's able to do these kind of, you know, Fred Astaire style dances.
Oh,
I mean,
he
it's
likes the
pretty,
yeah.
pretty amazing.
Cool,
you know,
right.
I mean, very talented people on there.
Your father, a filmmaker, for anyone who doesn't know, Barry Levinson, a legendary filmmaker. And I find most people who care about cinema are anti social media or have some knee jerk.
You think that there's like a strong
conservatism? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Scorsese makes some good TikToks with his daughter, but outside of that, I feel like people worry about what it's doing to attention spans in terms of.
Yeah, but I'm not.
People sitting down to watch a movie or a show or read a book, God forbid.
But I'm not, my issue with TikTok and social media doesn't have to do with attention span. It's not, I don't see it as a competitor to filmmaking in that respect. I do think it's bad for the soul.
Right.
That's my concern.
It's not about movie.
It's
about the soul.
Yeah. Can confirm. Yeah. 100%.
You and I spoke before this season aired. Yeah. I got to see the first three episodes early. We did an interview for print about those episodes and what had happened between the two seasons. And I'm still stuck on you sort of rejecting my read about a generational divide in this show. And I hear it even from you so far in this conversation. To me, what I took from season three is these young people coming out into a world that we, anybody older than them, anybody older than Gen Z, I would say, have left them rubble, ruins, no opportunities. All we've left them is the soul-deadening internet and a frontier spirit of go figure it out. Like, Nate could have just as easily been trying to make an app in this season, right? Mm-hmm. Like, trying to to be an evil tech guru. That would have been an alt. That's an alt draft.
Session euphoria crossover.
But I wonder, you don't feel any sort of, I don't know if guilt is the right word, but at least apprehension about what previous generations have wrought for the youth. Because that to me feels like a big theme of this season, even when it comes to Nate building an old folks home to then make money off of burying all the boomers who are dying.
Boomer dies every 15 seconds. You fast forward 10 years from now, it's a tidal wave of death.
I mean, I don't know. Is it harder to come into adulthood today than it was during the Vietnam War, World War II, the Great Depression, the turn of the century?
The pills are worse and the internet is worse. I don't, you know, as you've said, but maybe those are just eternal issues that just taking different forms.
Yeah.
Good versus evil.
Well, yeah, but it's also like people are more depressed, more anxious than they've ever been. I think a part of it is we live in America. You can DoorDash food to your house. You can log on to the internet and become interested in, you know, 100 million different subjects. You can learn about all of human history. You have everything at your fingertips. I don't know if it's like, I wouldn't describe it as the previous generation left Gen Z with ruins. It feels hyperbolic.
I think a lot of people talk about potentially the decline of the American experiment.
Yeah.
Like, we peaked at some point and all we're doing is disassembling what came before.
I think if we believe that, it'll become true.
But you don't believe that.
No.
You see hope in the enterprise, the gumption, the kind of frontier spirit, as it were, of actual young people and also the young people on the show.
I believe what Ali says to Rue and to everyone, which is the future will be bright.
And if you believe it, stay clean. I promise you, the future will be bright.
I really do. I think that you can make the impossible possible. And that's not to discount, I think, people who have real hardships and are going through, you know, real tough shit in their life. But I also think that human beings have persevered and endured for thousands of years, and the world has only gotten better, just on a purely statistical level, you know, in terms of poverty, in terms of starvation,
lifespan,
everything. It's
medicine. Obviously.
Yeah. I just think it's culturally safe to say, man, dude, things are so fucked up and everything looks so dark and the American experiment's over. And
you think it's a defense mechanism against,
no, I just think that,
against disappointment?
I just think that because if you're right, then you're like, I was right. Yeah. I told you.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're wrong, you're like, wow, this is great.
But you are playing with that tension. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is the last shot not of the American flag?
Absolutely. But I think that's what, look, that you look at everything our country's gone through and the fragility of it. It's endured. We're still here. And I think that if we can kind of harness the creativity and optimism of people, then, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, I think that's what was so interesting to me about Ali saying the future will be bright despite the evidence to the contrary, despite the fact that he says it and people keep dying. Mm-hmm. That's what was really, I think, meaningful to me, is that it's, yes, there's a layer of irony to it, but it's also true.
There's a literal rocket ship happening in the background in right before Rue passes away. There's a SpaceX launch on television where what, 2-3 weeks out from the 2024 election. Was there special significance to you in the day of Rue's death that we see Ollie write down in his notebook, which has become his
book of the dead?
Book of the dead.
No, I don't think so. I don't get too hung up on kind of little Easter egg stuff like that, because
numerology is not your thing.
Yeah, just you can just go down a rabbit hole and suddenly it's, you know, everyone's going, sure, you know, Sam, when are we going to shoot? And you're like, well, I got to figure out the date here. You know what I mean?
Sure,
like,
the sun's in the right place.
I'm a filmmaker. I'm too aware of the job at hand. Look, I think just going back to what we were talking about, mm-hmm, it's, Ruth thinks she's following in the footsteps of Moses. And if you take that, you know, that story, it's, you know, at the time, you know, the Jews were slaves in Egypt. You know, there was no possibility of freedom. It did not exist. If you were born a slave, you died a slave. If you were part of royalty, you were born royalty, you died royalty. No one ever switched classes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the spirit of Moses saying, no, if we want to be free, we can be free. And I think that there's, and he was able to make the impossible possible. And I think that if we look at it as purely ironic, then we're doomed. And if we look at it as true, we're not.
Do you think much about the lives of the characters after the last scene and after the screen goes black? Because I wonder if some of the optimism that you're expressing about the country and about the future being bright, these characters, the ones who have not died, do you envision bright futures for them? Do you think
Cassie discovers a cure for cancer?
That is one of many things that are within her capacity.
No,
she's going to be a household name.
Yeah. She's so brilliant in that scene.
I'm going to be fucking famous. I'm not even going to be able to walk down the street. Lex, just you watch. I'm going to be a household name.
No, I don't. I do extensive background work on all the characters. I know their lives, you know, in and out. Mm-hmm. I studied method acting for 4 years, and I always hated getting on stage and you know, saying whatever lines it was. But I remember I worked on Richard III's childhood for like 9 months doing like sensory exercises and imagining what he was like on the playground and, you know, in elementary. I mean, it was nuts.
I loved the prep, not the execution.
I was like, you know, I think 20 years old, 21 years old, you know, and, you know, I was working in advertising, you know, at the time, and then, you know, going to acting school, and I would go to Home Depot and I'd buy like a metal rod and I would tape it to my legs and I'd walk around with like a hunch, you know, through New York at night and just work on Richard III. It was like how to sell Singer sewing machines during the day. Mm-hmm. And then at night it was Richard III. So I can tell you anything about any one of these characters. And I think that's always been a bit of the conceit of it, is the, you know, it's why the prologues became a thing, is it's almost like a psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. Here are the kind of defining moments in the characters' lives that may or may not have shaped them, mm-hmm, you know, into who
but
they
for
are.
But for the afterlife, that's
but,
not there.
But when it ends, it just ends. Yeah.
You alluded to humor before, and I think it's something that maybe is not discussed enough about this show
or
The Idol, which is, we should absolutely talk about The Idol. Can you talk about why you think humor is so valuable in your work and why it's not often read as humorous?
Yeah, that was big for me. Yeah. We watched a little bit of the first couple episodes together on the Warner Brothers lot, and I was struck by not only how much you wanted to watch. You just kept being like, no, I'm just going to watch this one more scene. Like, check out this part. Like, you know, it was like, I could see the excitement, but also knowing even then that when people are sitting at home watching on their TV or their laptop or their phone, even, they might not be feeling the dark humor that you're intending. Do you feel misunderstood as a comedic writer and director?
I find the show deeply funny. Mm-hmm. And I found every season to be deeply funny. I think that there's layers of irony and humor that are there. And whenever we show an episode in a theater, people are cracking up. Even the pilot, I remember sitting with HBO in Austin and people were laughing in the pilot episode. And HBO was like, oh, wow, it's like people think the show's funny. I said, yeah, well, of course. But it was a window into realizing, oh, some people don't think the show's funny. Mm-hmm. And I think I've noticed there is something that's happening online where I think it's like the hyper online don't pick up humor or irony as much as like the average audience member. And I think it's there, but at the same time, they're kind of more advanced than a casual viewer in terms of like plot progression and mm-hmm. certain details. Mm-hmm. But there is like a kind of a flattening of humor and irony where they tend to take everything very literally. Mm-hmm. I often wonder why exactly that is. And I think it's because they're so kind of attuned to, you know, what's acceptable and not acceptable. I think it's like I think politics play a really big role in it. You know, is this okay? You know, is this person good? Is this person bad? Am I supposed to like them or not? What are they doing? Is this a redemption arc? Is this not? There's all these kinds of, you know, questions that come before the normal sort of, you know, instinctive.
Am I enjoying this?
Yeah, am I enjoying it? Is it funny? Is it entertained me? Is it thrilling?
And also, am I allowed to laugh right. at this? That's really the thing, is because I think the nature of the subject matter, there's a first step before the laugh, which is, can I walk in that door?
And right. And what is this discomfort I'm feeling for? And that's something you've really leaned into and pushed up against as I think the Euphoria snowball has grown and people have dug their heels in about, this guy is a sicko. Like whoever this person
which
is
who also is funny.
Doing and writing this is a sicko. And you seem to have said, oh yeah, watch me get way up. Sicker. This third season includes essentially every image and slur that you're not supposed to think about or repeat or say or
but
do.
But why not?
Well, and that's my question for you, which is, why is it interesting or important to you to do those things on screen in this medium?
Because it's a reflection of the world. I mean, that's what's interesting to me is, you know, you've got characters who are, you know, Nazis and fentanyl dealers who are dealing fentanyl that's killing people. But what certain audience members get upset about mm-hmm. is not the fentanyl that's killing people. It's the fact that they said the N-word. That seems very strange to me because one, they would say it, and two, they're doing way worse things than just saying the N-word. It's an odd gripe, and fixation. It's part of a larger kind of trend in storytelling that's happened, I think, over the last 10 years, where there's a sort of a utopian mode of storytelling where people would like characters to represent this kind of the most politically evolved versions of themselves mm-hmm. so that it can impart some kind of lesson. Mm-hmm. It's really hurt the medium of film and television, and it's dishonest.
Yeah, the world is coarse.
Yeah.
The world is coarse and complicated, and that tendency, I sometimes can't help but think of after school specials in the 80s where everything is oriented towards a lesson or a value set, which then, of course, made people rebel against the value set and the lessons.
Right. It's also important to see people make bad decisions on screen because it allows us to dip our toe into worlds that we're not necessarily in, to experience things, to wrestle with moral questions and human behavior and desire. I think it's really important for things not to be, you know, kind of bizarre propaganda pieces. And I don't know how it came about. I mean, you know, there was sort of an era of the anti-hero, you know, from, you know, Sopranos and Breaking Bad and these things. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. Why did it change?
I mean, I think there was a perception of the coarseness of American life in the mid to late 2010s that I think created a culture industry that sought to remedy that. And then a lot of what we
but
are.
Has it remedied? No, I mean,
you know. And I also think it's sort of false to look at culture as a panacea. I think it should be reflective. I think it should be messy. I think that creative things don't have to be morally virtuous. I think more, you know, I think to me, they don't have to line up in that way. But I do think in terms of what people were expecting of culture, I think there was a hope towards the end of the 2010s into the early 2020s that perhaps culture could be a corrective for these kind of declining tendencies in American social and political life. But I think what you are doing is truer to the state of the country.
Yeah.
I also think these conversations do predate even that moment. I think that's the most recent upswing of it.
Sure.
Of woke 1.0 or whatever you want to call it. But I think of someone like Scorsese, and you mentioned earlier making these things that ultimately may be bad, quote unquote, alluring. And that's something that he's gotten in trouble for his entire career, to the point where I think in his later films he's often said, like, and by the way, this is bad, by the end of the film, sometimes him literally getting up to the microphone in Flower Moon and saying, like, by the way, we shouldn't have done all of that. and who am I to even be telling this story?
Maybe that's what is missing from
at the end of every episode. You should just go,
I should just make a cameo,
just a quick walkthrough.
But I wonder about this idea of how far do you like to go in terms of making this stuff seem glamorous and seem awesome? Because I do think for a maybe less experienced viewer of film or television, it could be brain scrambling to be like, well, this all looks pretty great, much like the first hour 10 of Goodfellas, you know, like this seems sick. So why wouldn't I want to follow in the footsteps of these characters?
Look, I think that that's a really valid, you know, question. And it's something that I wrestle with. And I know our team does too, just in terms of producers and cinematographers and that, you know, even going back to like the Garden of Eden, it's not like the serpent came to Eve and said, this is going to be the worst decision you've ever made in your life. We have to portray the seduction of these illicit behaviors and in a way that's truthful and reflective of their draw in our own lives. What's most important to me is showing the consequence of it. I mean, Rue says it, I think, in one of, maybe it's the second episode of the first season, where she says, you know, they're like, they're doing the drugs under the tent with the, you know, glitter. Some, she said, like, there's, you know, it's like drugs are cool.
I know you're not allowed to say it. The drugs are kind of cool.
In the same way that, like, smoking is cool,
or guns, or
or any bit, until it's not. And we cut to her and she's getting wheeled out of her house, you know, on a stretcher because she OD'd, and you know, her family is sitting there in the hospital with her, and we reveal that it's not just that she's hurting herself, but she's in fact destroying the lives of everyone around her. So I think it's always a fine line. Have we gotten it right 100% of the time? It's hard to really know, but I think we have shown the psychological, physical, and sort of spiritual consequences of addiction in all of its forms better than almost anything else out there. And that, I think, helps me sleep at night.
And is that also that choice of showing it being very alluring, shimmering, attractive, and then consequently, I mean, that is, it's a literalization of addiction itself.
It mirrors the kind of emotional swings of life as an addict, and also tell a story that's reflective of internet culture in the sense that it can swing wildly between, you know, something incredibly, you know, tragic and then something very funny, something that plays more like a romantic comedy to something that's absolutely horrifying. You know, I wanted to mirror the kind of emotional, you know, kind of madness of scrolling through the internet, of just flipping through Instagram. Ah, it's a dog video. That's so sweet. Oh, here's like a bar fight, you know, in the Ozarks.
I gave my brother a New York Times subscription.
She sent me a year-long subscription, so I have access to all the games. We'll do Wordle, Mini, Spelling Bee.
It has given us a personal connection.
We exchange articles.
And so having read the same article, we can discuss it.
The coverage, the options, it's not just news.
Such a diversified gift.
I was really excited to give him a New York Times cooking subscription so that we could share recipes. And we even just shared a recipe the other day.
The New York Times contributes to our quality time together.
You have all of that information at your fingertips.
It enriches our relationship, broadening our horizons.
It was such a cool and thoughtful gift.
We're reading the same stuff. We're making the same food. We're on the same page.
Connect even more with someone you care about. Learn more about giving a New York Times subscription as a gift at nytimes.com/gift.
You're talking about the addiction aspect, the violence aspect. Then there's the sexualization
that's
in the show from the very beginning, when these are, you know, supposed to be high school characters and they're also young actors. And there's been a lot of complaints over the years that the show is over-sexualized, that there's nudity when there doesn't need to be nudity. You've spoken about it a bit in the past. Obviously, in many cases, these are adults and creative collaborators of yours. We don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes. You've worked with intimacy coordinators.
Yeah.
How do you think about what meaningful consent is for the actors in these scenarios, given that many of them were at the very beginnings of their career or were trying to make a name for themselves, much like the characters themselves in the show, especially in the third season, in terms of what they feel comfortable doing on camera or on screen?
I believe very strongly that the best, most honest performances are when an actor feels free and safe. That's how you get a great performance. You can't, if there is any tension, it's almost, the emotion is going to be blocked. And that's something I've known from my days of studying acting. So my job is to create the kind of best, most conducive environment for the actor to then, you know, play this character. And so I care most about the emotional honesty of it and the well-being of the people that I work with. It's a long game, you know. This isn't some, you know, 5-day shoot, you know, thing. This is seasons and years of working with people. And so you want to make sure that people are protected, they're comfortable.
And clearly you've built up that trust.
Yeah.
We've seen what you've done with Sydney Sweeney this season, especially given how much her star has risen since season 2 and especially since season 1. Can you talk a little bit about what that creative relationship is like to get to the point where she's comfortable doing, you know, the intro of episode 5 in this, which is a montage of her online sex work? You know, we don't see a lot of A-list actresses doing that. Can you talk a little bit about the bond that you guys have creatively behind the scenes that allows for something like that to make it to screen?
Well, it's funny. When I first wrote it, you know, I had a, you know, I thought well, maybe we shoot all of this and there, you know, we just, you know, we don't have any nudity or, you know, thing. And I was talking to her about, you know, maybe there's ways to shoot around certain, and she looked at me and she's like, are you kidding? It's like, I'm playing an OnlyFans model. You're telling me you're going to like skirt around it. And I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah. That's a fair point. And so there's always a discussion of what works best for the character. I think she's a totally fearless actor. She's also just wonderfully professional and, you know, shows up just game every day. And I adore working with her because there's such a kind of a flexibility in terms of the performance. She can, you know, I can say, well, you know, why don't we try this scene just a little crazier, like a little more, with a little more humor. And suddenly just this whole other version of the scene can come out just based on her performance. So I, you know, there's a lot of trust that we have. And look, I think we're tackling, you know, this world of OnlyFans where women are being paid to like whisper into an ear-shaped microphone and lick it. There is a level of absurdity to it that is just fun.
We talk a lot about these actors becoming who they've become since you've known them. And obviously that became a logistical puzzle in terms of the making of this season with everybody, you know, working on Oscar-winning auteur films or blockbusters in the case of Zendaya, sometimes both at the same time. How was that puzzle for you? And did it result in having to sacrifice your creative vision? Like, did you get what you wanted out of the character arcs of, say, Nate and Jules, who were a bit sidelined this season?
Logistically, it was very tough. We had to crossboard all 8 episodes. It's 178 days of shooting.
What does that mean for
so,
the...
Oh, crossboard. Yeah. So, you know, for instance, when you shoot a show, usually you'll shoot scenes from say 2 episodes at a time. This season we had to shoot scene. We would do a scene from episode 8, you know, in the morning, a scene from episode 3, and another scene from episode 1.
When you have the actor, you
because
needed.
Just yeah, because of access, yeah, just because talent, of schedules. Yeah. So it made it difficult because we had to go, you know, sometimes you have to go back to a location 3 times just because of the, you know, this actor is not available. So logistically it becomes tough, and then at the same time you have to keep it all on budget and schedule. So in terms of the story, I tend to look at it more like a film instead of a television show. I understand the architecture of TV where, you know, you have 5 characters and you always tell a piece of their story every single episode. That's not how I've ever really gone about Euphoria. I think of it as sometimes a character takes a front seat, sometimes they take a back seat, sometimes they're in an episode, sometimes they're not. It's just, it's whatever the story requires and whatever the engine is. So, you know, in terms of Nate's role, you know, his life and his lies and all of the wheeling and dealing that he does is the engine for Cassie's story, which mm-hmm. becomes the kind of the bigger arc of the season, as opposed to each episode we're gonna delve into his specific struggles. I think because audiences know the history of these characters, it gets compared to what, you know, well, in this season he had this sure. and that, and
people,
you know,
are deeply invested
which is a blessing, but it comes down to what's right for the story and what keeps it moving and the audience engaged. And that's how I look at it. And I don't think that I had to compromise.
One question about the TV as film or the sort of viewing TV as making film. Your father also, in addition to making many films, made a lot of great television, Homicide: Life on the Street.
I love that show. Show doesn't get enough.
Most important show of my life,
Frank Pemberton.
Potentially, like, one of the things I thought was so special about that show is it's a procedural, of course, but it's sort of like an art house procedural. I wonder, when you look at the hours of television that your father was making and the hours of television that you're making, are there lessons that you're pulling from what he was able to do in a very different era on a major network? Things that you take from that and say, how do I bring that into something more experimental, more outre, and also more risque?
I think of TV like a playground, and it's a playground to tell stories that aren't necessarily inside of the structure of a film. A film needs specific things. Anti-hero characters kind of fit better in TV than they do in films. You know, I think a film sort of requires a hero in some ways. And then the other, you know, big influence was Oz. And, Adebisi.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
You know, Adewale when I first met him, I said, you're the reason I did not want to go to prison.
This is an early HBO show for our young viewers.
Yeah, I just thought, I never want to be locked in a cell with this guy, you know. But in general, I think that I grew up loving movies. That's sort of my main inspiration. And you know, I think of television as a place to tell long form stories and to be playful and experimental at times. And so I don't look at it with the hard kind of architectural plans that I think a traditional great showrunner, you know, would.
I want to talk a little bit more about your film influence. I pulled this quote, Levinson doesn't violate his characters by summing them up. He understands that we never fully understand anybody. That's Pauline Kael on Diner, your father's movie, which I think also can apply to your work. Mm-hmm. And I do think in part, some of the disconnect with the Euphoria audience can be that a lot of them are younger and aren't coming with the same reference points that you are. I think a lot about Tarantino watching this season and the previous season, but I'm curious about your relationship to Tarantino's work in particular. But I also think you guys like a lot of the same stuff, whether that's Westerns or Kung Fu movies or blaxploitation, exploitation films. What kind of primer would you give someone who's seen Euphoria if they wanted to go backwards? This can be a gateway drug, as it were.
Yeah.
So if people were going to go back through filmmakers, through television, to try to understand what it was you were doing here, what kind of path would they travel?
I worked in a video store when I was younger, when I was a teenager.
Another Tarantino parallel.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think he was
deeper in.
He was deeper into the clerk life than I was. But in terms of what shaped my sense of humor, I think Todd Solondz was a really big influence on me. I think Welcome to the Dollhouse specifically was a movie that I just adored, and I found it hysterical in terms of kind of sheer filmmaking chops and storytelling through camera as opposed to words. I think, you know, Leone is a big influence. In terms of my favorite director of all time is probably William Wyler. Mm-hmm. Like Mrs. Miniver, I think, is a perfect movie.
Am I right to see some Verhoeven in here?
Verhoeven, without a doubt, is maybe one
when we talk about these levels of irony.
Yeah, William Wyler and Verhoeven are sort of where it... Verhoeven is, I think, an absolute genius, technically speaking, in terms of the craft, but also the layers of irony. In terms of dialogue, I love Preston Sturges. There's no one better. Now, but these are all very kind of disparate.
Of course. From a lifetime of
love. I mean, I'm just, it's also like what's on the top of my mind at the moment. Right. But I love movies. It's how I learned about the world in some ways. I mean, you know, I don't know if you know the New York Times accent test, you know this thing?
Yeah, of course. Amazing thing.
Okay, so I took the accent test.
Yeah.
And it was the...
It's about regional dialogue.
Yeah.
Regional dialect.
Mm-hmm. The the results were very strange. It said that I was from Illinois, but also like I've got some Southern thing in me and then another thing in deep. Yep. It was three places that mm-hmm. I've, you know, never spent any time right. in.
You grew up in the Northeast.
I grew up in Northern California, Connecticut, and then New York. And I was sitting there and I couldn't figure it out. And then I think it was my wife, Ash, said, I think it's possible that you learned words through movies. Watching TCM. Mm-hmm. So, if someone sure. says, you know, it's like someone says Illinois as opposed to Illinois, mm-hmm. it might come from like Jimmy Stewart in mm-hmm. Call Northside 777. Like right. it's kind of how I learned about the world.
That's how I feel about music.
Yeah.
No, sure. genuinely. That's how I feel about
music. I want to just ask you about the reception of this season. Yeah. I think the reviews were not kind coming out of the first batch.
Well, they
of
saw
episodes.
The first three episodes.
Right. And I wonder if you think that the negative reaction from both critics and some fans who are always loud on social media, as we've alluded to throughout this interview, how much of that do you think was about how different this season is, the leap that you're taking both in time and with the characters and setting, taking them out of the high school milieu? And how much of it is external? Do you think the reaction to the idol and the backlash around that colored how people received this season?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm more inclined to ask you guys, since you're a little deeper in the world than I am. I focus on making the thing and then and then I kind of go, this is it. I'm really proud of this.
I think to answer Joe's question about the relationship between the idol reception and this, I do think that they are linked, but I do go back to the thing that you said earlier about the humor of the idol. And I think there's like maybe a misapprehension of the tone of the idol that perhaps has become hovered over into season three of Euphoria. I do think also people who have lived a lot of life since Euphoria season one may view season three through a lens of skepticism or frustration, whereas I would imagine people who are arriving to it new, people who are younger, people who are coming, might see opportunity and see all the big lessons that you're putting on the screen. They might engage with it. But this is not to play industry exec, but I do think the space between the seasons, the amount of time that people had to build narratives of what it could be, what it's not being, it's taking too long, it's not a, people sort of get to write their own narratives in four-year gap. And so no matter what you deliver in the fourth year, you're fighting against what's in people's heads.
Not to mention the pileup of parasocial relationships happening here. I think,
of course,
you could feel this already in season two. Yeah. Our colleague Mark Tracy wrote a great story that you and I discussed off camera about people loving these characters you created so much, but hating the person who created them and who is pulling the puppet strings. And I think that combined with people's relationship to the actors themselves and the celebrities and how that has grown, plus your interest, some would say obsession with provocation. And I think when the idol was like a match on the bonfire of all of those things. Mm-hmm. And then I think a lot of people went into this season expecting a car wreck, expecting that pile up, and maybe with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder about how things were playing out. I think the season gets stronger when you see it all together.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of isolated moments, but that's the problem with the fact that ultimately you are making a week to week TV show. You're not making a nine hour film or whatever this would end up being. How does this ring to you?
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, look, I think that if it dropped all at once, I think people would, they'd understand it more. I think I'm always, in terms of the ratings they've held and they're fantastic.
Extremely popular show.
Yeah.
It's a huge conversation starter.
So people are still engaged. I always think that there's something that television does, which makes me disinterested in it. And I'm not saying all television, but it is a sort of a technique where it's, you know, they introduce the world, the characters, and then they let you know where everything is headed right off the bat. You know, these stakes aren't that high. This is what the season's going to be, and this is what you can expect, which is something that if I see in a television show, I immediately get disinterested because then I know where it's headed and I know the story that it's going to tell. And, you know, and so I think I try not to do that purposefully. I want to keep people going, well, how the fuck is this all going to come together here? How does this connect to this? And how are these characters going to interact? And what is this season actually about? I think is that's what keeps people engaged and on the edge of their seats. Otherwise, if you telegraph it too much, it loses its sort of power.
Is that also why you've sort of remained something of a cipher as well? You haven't done loads of press. You haven't talked a lot about the work. You've left a lot of blank space for people to fill in. And I wonder if that's part of what you're seeing in that pushback about season three in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's all kinds of crazy like narratives and conspiracies and things that sort of pop up, you know, on about, well, this show and, you know, I heard this and he did that. And I always go, what am I going to do? Just come out and say, well, actually the truth is X, Y, and Z. It doesn't, at the end of the day, I then get sucked into the world that I'm actually portraying, which is the split between the person and the persona.
Yeah.
And I'm not interested in managing a persona. I find it's not about the work. There is no fulfillment. You'll never win no matter what your desires are.
Fighting internet narratives.
Yeah. But it's also like I have children and a family that I love and I love spending time with. And, you know, I go, so what am I going to do? I'm going to go out and I'm going to give this interview and hope these people like me. And this, I don't
play whack-a-mole with the rumors.
Yeah. I don't give a shit. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, like I want to put energy into things that give energy back. And that's the work. It's the creative process. It's my crew. You know, we've had the same crew for almost a decade, I'd say 85-90% of them. You know, these people are, it's the cast, these people are family. And I love telling stories and I love the process of making something and seeing what kind of creativity is sparked in all of these departments. We're working with thousands of people, you know, from production designers to costume designers, set builders, it's cinematographer, gappers. It's so thrilling. And every single day you show up on set, you learn something new. There's always a new problem. There's a new obstacle. And do you overcome it or do you not? And it mirrors, I think, the story of Euphoria this season, which is there are obstacles and there are decisions you make. And can you overcome it or are you going to get sort of subsumed by it? And so that's my big takeaway from it all is, you know, look, it's nice to sit here and have a conversation, you know, but, you know, I didn't know it would be this nice to you know, sit here.
Well,
I don't want to do this for day in and day out.
Yeah, sure. You know, yeah. So I have to ask the final question, which is you nor HBO have used the term series finale when it comes to this episode that just aired. When you and I spoke a couple months ago, you left the door open that there might be potentially more Euphoria in the future, but I did not know at the time. And obviously you did not want to tell me that Rue was going to die at the end of season three. Is there a chance for more Euphoria moving forward?
In terms of the story that we set out to tell, which is a story about addiction and its consequences, this feels like the end to me. It was such a fulfilling journey in terms of this cast, the crew, what we were able to accomplish. I mean, there are thousands of things that have to go right in order to make something like this. And I'm just immensely proud of the work we did, the story we told. And, you know, it's a tragic one in the end, but it's also, it's the truth. You know, if you are experimenting or taking drugs today, it's very possible it'll kill you. And I think it was a way of honoring Angus and saying a prayer for the future.
So that's it. Euphoria ends here with Rue.
Yeah. What else is there to say?
Closing the chapter on the show is one thing, but what about for you? What does that do? What does that free up?
You know, it's interesting because I've put so much of myself into this show, and I think, you know, the actors as well, that it's exciting to dream about the possibilities. I mean, I love telling stories. I love writing. I love directing. And so I think the future will be bright.
Sam, every episode of Popcast ends with a snack.
Yeah.
You walked in and your eye was immediately drawn to these.
Mm-hmm. New in the pantry.
Wow. Brand new, brought in by producer Sophie today. These are coriander flavored Doritos. Coriander is cilantro? I would call this cilantro.
Yeah, based cilantro. On
the photo.
Yeah.
Is that the same? Is that? I don't know that.
Yeah, I don't know
those terms. Yeah. This isn't Top Chef.
Term.
Right, I know.
How am I supposed to know different all these show. Things?
Incredible bag. Extremely beautiful.
Keep your eye out for that green. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, this green is an Easter egg for podcast viewers. While we dig into these Doritos, this is a big...
But how many of these do I have to eat?
That's up
many
to you.
As you want.
That's up to you. We're going to start with one.
We're going to rate them at the end.
You're having them
as well? We're all going to eat it.
Well, this makes me feel better.
No.
I thought you guys were just going to watch me eat these.
No. We were going to watch you eat a snack.
I don't know. I was confused by the whole
premise. That's a different...
John and I are very into junk food, one of our mutual interests. So we thought we'd bring it to the show when the show started. And then we thought we'd bring our guests into it. One of the other things John and I have in common is a deep scholarly professional relationship with Drake and the work of Drake, who is an executive producer on this show. I'm curious, as we eat these Doritos, what he was like as a collaborator, how hands-on he was.
Did he give notes?
Yeah, did he ever give a note that you enacted?
That's a very small chip.
I figured you want me to get a full.
I just
want one of
something
chip.
Close to there a full go. Triangle. Yeah, there we go.
No, look, Drake had gotten a hold of the scripts, very early on into the process. And, you know, this is when HBO was... they still weren't sure about the show, and we were pushing some boundaries, and he said I want to come on as a producer, I want to come on as an EP, and he brought a level of confidence to HBO that I will forever be grateful for. I think that they couldn't believe that Drake was coming on, and he was more involved in promotional and marketing aspects of it, as opposed to, another producer is giving notes, I always imagined this character would do this,
But he knew how to sell it.
Yeah. And you need your champions to give other people confidence. And he was a champion.
John jumped ahead of us.
Sorry. Oh, yeah. How is it?
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers to everybody. Yes. Cheers. Cheers to you. I did jump ahead, but you know why?
Oh, all right.
That's because it's so fragrant.
It sort of tastes like a Fruit Loop.
You guys didn't smell the bag.
It's got a Fruit Loop, that kind of slight chemical taste in Fruit Loops.
Complimentary, not derogatory, I assume.
No, it's a nice chemical.
Yeah, exactly.
It starts as the cilantro that you would find on a nice Szechuan dish or whatever, herbaceousness.
Yep.
And then it goes through its Fruit Loop phase. Yeah. And then it just sort of ends at plain Dorito.
Yeah. I totally agree.
It doesn't all hold together for me.
No, but there's a full arc to the taste.
There is an arc for sure.
I think you're wilding. Almost every
this one has
Dorito.
a lot of dust
powder on it. Yeah, it's a heavy dust.
No. Which one are we looking at? Oh, I see.
You see?
Yeah. Almost every new Dorito, Dorito.
Yeah.
I think is very good. And you with the umlaut.
Yeah.
Every new Dorito is good.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. This ends as normal Dorito.
Yeah.
But I really do think the ride through the fragrantness of it is so sharp. It's so bright.
It has a sweetness.
This is the thing. Like, when I eat a Dorito, I'm already predisposed to think, damn, I'm going to feel bummed at the end of this. Because it's just like, I know what the heaviness of the chip is. But this starts so bright and so
it's
high.
Really bright.
Yeah. That it kind of like, it gives me, it's optimistic. Yeah. It's optimistic, much like Euphoria Season 3, I guess.
It's ultimately optimistic.
Ultimately, it's an optimistic chip.
Right.
Yeah, I'm rocking with this.
What's your favorite type of Dorito?
I'm now partial to purple, the spicy sweet chili one.
Yeah.
But Cool Ranch, I mean, our running joke is I find Cool Ranch spicy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
John has a bit of a sense
I have a sense of power.
This has a spicy kick now that I'm like.
My favorite Dorito is a West Coast Dorito, is the Tapatio Dorito, which is like pretty hard to get out here, but frequently available.
There was like
7-Elevens in LA.
Yeah.
There was a purple one that I found in London.
Different than
but it was
the
different
spicy
than this American purple one.
Yeah, send us those.
Which was pretty good.
Was it good? Was it also spicy?
It had a little
but like
kick
in a
to
British
it.
Context.
Yeah, I guess so.
Before we give our scores, I just want to round out the Drake conversation, which is to ask what it was like to be invoked, to have your show invoked in the Drake Kendrick beef. One of Kendrick's first disses in that back and forth was titled Euphoria. Was that meaningful to you?
I mean, it might have been more meaningful if I sometimes I go through phases where I just tune out all
popular
pop
culture.
Sure. Like I don't see any new movies for a couple of years, listen to new music. And I just
you were underground during that moment?
Oh, 100%.
Convenient.
Yeah. Very very conveniently. Yeah. It's true because sometimes I get fed up with there's always this sort of race to see the new thing, hear the new thing. Oh, yeah. And so I turn off the internet and then I was writing, I think.
Yeah, it was summer 24, spring, summer 24.
To be honest, I couldn't tell you one thing about the song. Other than I said, oh, it's named Euphoria. Is this, I said, well, does he talk about the show? And someone said, no. Yeah, and I said, okay.
Yes,
it's true. It was an illusion, maybe, but not.
I said, okay, and I just moved on and kept writing,
Fair enough.
So,
7 out of 10.
It's an 8. It's an 8.5.
Wow.
It's an 8.5 out of 10.
Okay.
The chip?
Yeah.
Wow.
We need a number. Give us a ranking.
What do you think?
I mean, well, what rating?
10
just
is
on
like a perfect snack.
10. Yeah.
Perfect snack.
Yeah, perfect snackability.
I would never eat this again.
So it's a 0.
Would you eat this again?
I would eat it. I would eat the whole bag.
You go to a bodega and buy it.
100%.
That's insanity.
Thank you.
That's totally fucking. Well, why is it sitting here then? Yeah.
We just got it.
Why is it sitting here?
Are you really going 0 or are you
giving
a point
zero.
For
I just.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. It's not bad.
Didn't move you.
It's
like a 5.
Yeah, it's a 5.
All right. Well, then more for me.
Yeah, that's true.
We did not get to tell the story, unfortunately, about you meeting Scarface at Marshawn Lynch's and Too Short's joint birthday party.
100 years of culture.
100 years of culture, much like Popcast itself, 100 years of culture. We'll save it for next time. Sam Levinson.
Thank you
for being here.
What a ride. Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. We're on YouTube, of course, like and subscribe, youtube.com/popcast. We're on Instagram. Maybe we're on TikTok. It's tough to say these days. Who can really say? Sam's not going to see us there.
No.
So maybe we shouldn't be on TikTok. You let us know. Credits and link in bio. We will be back next week. We're out.